All right, we're going to start in Genesis 29, and we're going to just go and see how far we get today. We'll probably get to Genesis 34. So Genesis 29 starts with Jacob going on his journey. He's going to go north to a place called Haran, and that's going to be in modern-day Turkey. And in the slide, you can see an image of basically where that is up north. And he goes to meet a relative, and we've heard this guy's name before, and his name is Laban. And you can see the relationship that Jacob has to Laban. Laban and Jacob come from the same, you know, great-grandfather of Terah. So you can see the slide where I kind of show you the relationship between Jacob and his wives. They're essentially cousins, but it's, you know, I'm not a genealogical expert, so you can kind of see the relationship, how they're removed there in the slide. But essentially, he goes there, and as soon as he meets Rachel, as soon as Jacob meets her in verse 11, I don't suggest this as a dating technique, by the way, but the first thing he does is he kisses her and he weeps. So he's pretty happy. And then as soon as this happens, Laban comes out to him, the father of this woman that he just kissed, and he said, "Surely thou art my bone and my flesh." And he abode with him for the space of a month. So that's verse 14. And Laban said to Jacob, "Because you're my brother, shouldst thou not serve me for naught? Tell me, what shall thy wages be?" And so he's basically saying, you know, what do you want? And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and was well-favored. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, "I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter." So he essentially says, let me live here. I'll serve you. I want to marry Rachel. Now, Leah gets kind of a bad rap here. And in the footnote to verse 17, where it says she was tender-eyed, it just says beauty. But in the Hebrew, that word means soft or delicate. But the Greek translators, remember the Old Testament was written in Greek after Alexander and after Hellenism kind of takes over. And everybody's, all the Jews are speaking Greek and they're reading Greek. And the rabbis say, basically, we've got to get the Bible written in Greek or else people aren't going to read it. So they translate it. And in the Greek, or what's called the Septuagint in the Greek text, it says that she is asthenes. That's not a good word. That's a word that's translated in the Greek New Testament as sick or feeble or sickly. And so this is a tough thing. Are they saying that she's ugly? Are they saying that she's weak? You know, there's a lot we don't know. In the Institute student manual, it just says this. The Hebrew word translated as tender means soft or delicate or lovely. The fact that this trait is emphasized for Leah while Rachel is described as beautiful and well-favored, that is, beautiful in every respect, seems to suggest that Leah's eyes were her most attractive feature. So that's the Old Testament explanation in the student manual for you. So do with it what you may, but there's some tension here in Genesis 29. And you probably already know this story, right? Romantically, you know, verse 20 is such a romantic verse. It says, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love that he had to her. And that's just so tender. And he loves her so much. Leah, not so much. And so what happens? Well, this is the story where the trickster gets tricked. Jacob, who tricked in one account in Genesis 27, right, where he tricks his dad to get the birthright, he gets deceived here. And so this is karma in effect. And so he goes to get married. And it says that it came to pass that evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and he brought her to him, and he went in unto her. So this is Laban taking his daughter Leah, the one that Jacob doesn't want to marry, and he marries her. Now, it doesn't say how this goes down. We're assuming that maybe there was a veil or there was something happening or maybe this happens at night. I don't know. But for some reason, he wakes up in the morning and he says in verse 25, it came to pass in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this thou hast done to me? Did not I serve with thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me? And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her a week and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet 7 other years. And so Jacob fulfilled the week, and then the next week he marries Rachel, and then he serves another 7 years. So he serves 14 years for Rachel. Verse 30 says, he went in also unto Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served with him, meaning Laban, yet 7 other years. And so that's the beginning of this contention between Leah and Rachel for the affections of Jacob. And not to make things more complicated, but we have to do this, right? He gets handmaidens. And so one of the handmaidens is Zilpah in verse 24. That is Leah's handmaiden. And Bilhah is Rachel's handmaiden. And so for a total of 4 women that are married to Jacob, and he has children by all 4 of these women, and the chart, you'll see it there in the notes there, of his family, we have essentially 6 sons from Leah: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. We have 2 sons from Zilpah, which is Leah's handmaiden, Gad and Asher. Rachel is going to have 2 sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And Bilhah is going to have Dan and Naphtali. And those are going to be referred to as the 12 tribes of Israel. Another important person that comes from this marriage to Leah is a woman named Dinah. Now, her story is going to pop up in the 34th chapter of Genesis. And so she's not counted as one of the 12 tribes because we're talking about inheritance, but she's mentioned in the narrative as one of the children of Jacob. So that's kind of a brief overview of what's happening as far as the family of Jacob. And the children are born in these chapters, starting in Genesis 29, verse 32, with Reuben. And so we get Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah at the end of chapter 29. And then we get more children born in chapter 30. And then in chapter 35 of Genesis, verse 18, we get Benjamin. So the bulk of the children are going to be born at the end of chapter 29 and chapter 30. It's pretty cool in the narrative with the names of the children, and they're all puns. It's a bunch of dad jokes all throughout. And the dad jokes are also related to not only the names, but actual geographical locations in and around Israel that a 9th century reader would have been familiar with. And so one of the things we think is happening is these stories are told in the context of where they lived, to describe the regions where they lived, and also to help people understand their history in those terms. I'm going to do first just some of the puns, some of the names essentially of these individuals. So if you go and you start first with Reuben. So you've got Reuben in chapter 29, verse 32. She called his name Reuben, and she said, "Surely the Lord has looked upon my affliction. Now therefore my husband will love me." So this is Leah conceiving. And Reuben literally means Yahweh has seen my affliction. So you've got seen, Ra'ah, and then you've also got, you know, Jehovah in there. Jehovah has seen. So Yehah Habani. So the Lord has seen my affliction. Then you have Simeon that she conceives, and that's in verse 33 of the 29th chapter. And Simeon literally means that Yahweh has heard that I was unloved, or that I've been heard. Then you've got Levi, and we read this: "This time my husband will become attached to me." It shows you there in chapter 29, verse 34, that Levi means joined or pledged. And then you get Judah, and that's in chapter 29, verse 35. "This time will I praise Yahweh," Yehuda. So this is to praise. Over and over again, we just see these puns popping up. So if you go to chapter 30, there's this competition, and Leah's winning. She's got all the kids, and she's competing for the affection of Jacob. So Bilhah is given to Jacob, and she is the handmaiden of Rachel. And verse 6 of chapter 30 says that she has a son, and his name is Dan, which is judged. And in the context here, Rachel said, "God has judged me and heard my voice and has given me a son." Therefore, she called his name Dan. Then you get to verse 8, and it says, "With great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." And she called his name Naphtali, or the wrestlings of God. And so over and over again, we see this. And even in the footnote, these puns are drawn out in verse 11, where it says, Leah said, a troop cometh, and she called his name Gad. So we have another child who was born called Gad. And in the footnote, it says, good fortune. Paronomasia in verse 11, footnote B, it just says basically paronomasia on the Hebrew words Gedud, troop, and Gad, fortune. So paronomasia is just a fancy way of saying puns. I like to say the word pun because it's easier than saying paronomasia. But if you want to sound really smart, just say, oh yeah, the paronomasia happening in Genesis is just incredibly distinct. And your listeners will think, wow, you're so smart. So anyway, we have paronomasia. We have punning happening. And so look in verse 13. Leah said, happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed. And she called his name Asher. So Asher literally means to be happy. What's interesting to me in verse 13, where she says, happy am I, another translation is, how fortunate is Be'osher. And then Be'osher is really another way of saying Asher, because in Be'osher you get the name Asher. The only difference between Osher and Asher is the vowel pointing. And so punning is just happening all over the place, but it's lost in the English translation. These names and these places are also associated with the geopolitical situation of the 9th century, and it's really big. It's bigger than this podcast. And so I will put notes out there for you if you're interested in reading some interesting things about how a 9th century reader would have understood these things. And it really helps to see how the Bible had relevance, that these stories that were told around the campfire that were eventually textualized had relevance to these people in their history, but also in their landscape. And so I'll give you one example. If you remember the story from Genesis 27, we read that Jacob is smooth, and we read that Esau is hairy. Well, smooth is Halak, and hairy is Seir. And geographically, the people that lived back then understood that Mount Halak and Mount Seir were literally the boundaries between Israel and Edom. And so the descendants of Jacob were the Israelites, and the descendants of Esau were the Edomites. And so the mountains, Mount Halak and Seir, which were the border locations of these two nations, relate to Jacob being Halak, smooth, and Esau being Seir, hairy. And so just that one example really helps us see that the Bible has so many layers to it, and that these people that read it and talked about it understood these things, and that they're lost on modern readers. And so some of this stuff's drawn out in the footnotes, but I just wanted to draw your attention to this, that even in the names of these children, you see this tension between Leah and Rachel for Jacob's happiness. It's also, in my opinion, one of my big plugs on, man, maybe plural marriage is not like so cool, because I don't see how this is a good thing with all this tension and those kinds of things. I just can imagine myself in this situation, and I pity everyone. I just feel like it'd be tough to be Jacob. It'd be tough to be Rachel. It'd be tough to be Leah. It'd be tough to be in all these circumstances. And we'll see this also played out later when Joseph is born, and how the brothers treat him and how Jacob treats Joseph. And so there's a lot of application here on just how we treat each other and family. And so I just want to say, when you have your family, I would highly advise you to love all your children. Now, we're not going to be able to give them all equal things. For example, one time my son said, hey, it's not fair that you gave me this and you gave your other son this. And I said, well, you know, he's 7. So would you like Legos for Christmas? Like, I'm not going to give a 16-year-old Legos for Christmas, right? In other words, I'm going to treat them according to the circumstance in which they're in, but I'm going to do my best to love them all the same. And I think that's how Heavenly Father is. He loves all of his children. Certainly, we're all in different circumstances and we have different capacity to receive things. But as parents, I think it's important that we do love our children equally, because sometimes these tensions come out. And it's also natural for parents to have a child that maybe they relate with better, or a child that they just understand more, or have more in common, but we should do all that we can to love them the same. And it's just a difficult thing in this circumstance where there's multiple wives and they're competing for Jacob's affection. So I have great empathy for, like I said, all these characters. I don't see any of this as easy, but it's in the Bible, so we have to deal with it because we're in it, right? We're reading it. And I don't want to skip the last sons. I think that they might be upset if we skip them. So you've got Issachar, a reward. God's given me my reward. Genesis 30, verse 18. And then you've got Zebulun. Zebulun is, now my husband will dwell with me. Dwelling. Now Zebulun's punning on a lot of levels. So this is what this is the verse that talks about Zebulun. Leah said, God has endued me with a good dowry, or God's given me a good gift. Now will my husband dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. And she called his name Zebulun. So this is Leah's child. This is her final son. And she says, now God has given me this gift and my husband will dwell with me. And so dwell, the root word is zabal, but the word for gift or dowry is Zebed, and we get this word for the son named Zebulun. So one way to look at it is, God's given me a choice gift, Zebed. This time my husband will exalt me, Yizbaleni. The stem of these words are just rooted in the name of Zebulun. Gift and dwelling and exalting, because dwell is Zebal, but it's also to exalt. And so it's like multivalent here, which is pretty cool. So Zebal, to dwell with, but also to exalt. And so anyway, those are the names of the kids. So after the kids are born, Jacob goes to Laban. It's been 14 years, and he says, hey, send me away. I'm ready to go. Give me my wives and my children, and I'm ready to peace out. I want to go. Pay me. Essentially, he says, you know what? You need to pay me. And Laban says, hey, tell me what you want me to pay you. What's interesting is behind this is this context of the slave law. Look in verse 25. We're in Genesis 30. It came to pass when Rachel had born Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away, and I may go into mine own place, into mine own country. Now, in Exodus 21, 2 through 4, it kind of talks about this idea that if you have a slave and he wants to be freed, he goes, but whatever wife you gave him, the wife stays. And so there's this tension in Genesis. Like, how is Laban going to treat Jacob? Is he going to treat him right? By the way, I also failed to mention Joseph's name, so he's kind of an important name. So if you look in Joseph, and it even shows you this in the footnotes, this is Genesis 30, verse 24, that Joseph relates to the Hebrew word yasaf, which means to add, to asaf, which means both to take away and to gather. So the context plays upon both of these meanings, because Joseph takes away, but he also adds. And how does he do this? Well, he restores Israel to their land. He restores Israel to their connection with God. He feeds them, but he also takes stuff away. You know, what does he take away? Well, we'll get to that when we get to the narrative at the end of Genesis. But Joseph is taking away and he's adding. And so his name is kind of punny. But back to this story with Laban. So, you know, I want to go. And then there's this, it's such a fascinating narrative, but it's usually skipped. In a Sunday school course where you were going to church on Sunday, typically verses 28 to the end of Genesis 30 are just skipped because we don't know, what do we do with this? But of course, we're going to talk about it because, well, it's in the Bible. So this is what it's talking about. The whole end of Genesis 30 is essentially talking about Laban and Jacob's tension. For 14 years, Jacob served him. He should be free to go. He's got the daughters. He's got his family. And essentially what Laban says is, you know, what do you want to pay? What do you want for pay? And Jacob says in verse 31, he says, pay me nothing. Verse 31 of the King James says, he said, what shall I give thee? And Jacob says, thou shalt not give me anything. If thou wilt do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep thy flock. And then starting in verse 32, it gets kind of clunky in the King James. And so I'm going to read from the Jewish Study Bible these verses to kind of give us an idea or a flavor for what's happening. So starting in verse 32, Jacob says, "Let me pass through your whole flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted animal, every dark-colored sheep, and every spotted and speckled goat. That'll be my wages." Okay, time out. That's just verse 32. Essentially, what he's saying is, let me pick the part of your flock that is super duper rare, the stuff that's not regular, and that'll be my wages. You see, anciently, goats were dark and sheep were white. And so what he tells him is, let me, Jacob says, get the opposite. So instead of the dark goats, let me get the spotted ones that have lots of white in them. Instead of the sheep that are white, let me get those that have dark color in them. And so they make this agreement. And one of the things the author of Genesis 30 wants to show you is that something like this, that's just so rare, when God touches it, it's going to be bountiful. It's going to be blessed. So look what happens. Verse 33. "In the future, when you go over my wages, let my honesty towards you testify for me," says Jacob. "If there's any among the goats that are not speckled or spotted, or any sheep that are not dark colored, they got there by theft." And Laban said, "Very well, let it be as you say." But that same day, he removed the streaked and spotted he-goats and all the speckled and spotted she-goats, every one that had white on it, and all the dark colored sheep, and he left them in the charge of his sons. And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Laban's flock. Jacob then got fresh shoots of poplar and of almond and plane and peeled white stripes in them, laying bare the white of the shoots. The rods that he had peeled, he set up in front of the goats at the troughs, the water receptacles that the goats came to drink from. Their mating occurred when they came to drink, and since the goats mated by the rods, the goats brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted young. Okay, what's going on? This is folklore. There was a folklorist belief that what animals saw while mating determined the appearance of their young. Thus, when the goats, which are normally dark in the ancient Near East, see the white of the shoots, they're going to have white offspring, or offspring that have white in them. Now, there's also some other punning happening here, because the word for Laban has the word for white in it. And so we're punning even with Laban's name. Literally, both Laban and white are Lavan, Lamed, Beit, Nun. And the Beit doesn't have the Dagesh in the middle of it. So it's Lavan. And so that's a level of punning that's happening here right in the middle of Genesis 30. This idea that we're going to make goats that are normally dark, they're going to come out white, and we're going to make sheep that are normally white, they're going to come out dark. And so what happens is, well, the dark colored sheep come out and we have speckled goats. Back to the narrative. So Genesis 30, verse 38. "The rods that he peeled, he set up in front of the goats. They drink out of their troughs." Verse 40. "Jacob dealt separately with the sheep, and he made these animals face the streaked or wholly dark-colored animals in Laban's flock. And so he produced special flocks for himself, which he did not put with Laban's flocks. Moreover, when the sturdier animals were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the troughs in full view of the animals, so that they mated by the rods. But with the feebler animals, he would not place them there. Thus the feebler ones went to Laban, and the sturdy animals went to Jacob." And so at the end of Genesis 30, through cunning craftiness, Jacob produces this massive flock of animals that are kind of rare. Like I said, we have dark sheep and light colored goats. And it says in verse 43 that the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle. And so this is kind of how it ends. He's ready to go and he's going to depart. And so that's chapter 31 of Genesis. In the 31st chapter, verse 3, "The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee." And so he gets up and gets ready to go. In verse 11, it says, "The angel of God spake to him in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I." And same thing, he's told to get up and go. What's interesting in 31 of Genesis is there's these two divine beings that tell Jacob to get out. Verse 3 says it's the Lord, and verse 11 says it's the angel. And in modern scholarship, what they believe is happening here is verse 3 comes from the Yahwist, and the rest of this narrative, 1 through 16, is a northern text. And so notice verse 11, that the angel of God speaks to him in a dream. Generally, from the northern perspective, the Elohist text has God revealed to prophets in dreams and visions, and specifically dreams. And in the southern tradition, God is generally portrayed in anthropomorphic terms as Yahweh, as it says in verse 3, and he just appears to him. And so anyway, that kind of helps bring out the distinction between those two visions. Is it God? Is it an angel? And the answer is, well, yes, it's just been put together by an editor and they put both in there. But the bulk of Genesis 31, 1 through 16, and frankly, the bulk of this chapter is a northern text explaining why he has to leave, the north and go back. Verse 13 says, I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar and where thou vowed a vow unto me. Arise, get thee from this land and return to the land of thy kindred. And so he leaves. He's going to leave this northern area and go back. And right in the midst of this is this huge tension, this huge conflict between Jacob and Laban and the daughters and the household gods and Rachel. And there's some hiding taking place. And it can be very confusing to modern readers. And we're going to hash this out here. First, the idea that Rachel's taking the household gods, these teraphim, these images. We read that Jacob raises up and he gets his family and they're going to get out. In verse 19, Laban went to shear his sheep and Rachel had stolen the teraphim, these household gods that were her father's. And he freaks out. And so he chases down Jacob and he's like, what's going on? And Jacob in verse 31 says, I was afraid that maybe you wouldn't let me go. In verse 32, whoever thou findest that took your gods, let him not live. Before our brethren discern thou what is thine with me. And so he says, hey, whoever took these household gods, let him die. Now in the Jewish Midrash, that the Jewish sages kind of talk about, you know, why did Rachel die so young? Their idea is, well, she died young because she took the teraphim. She took these household gods and Jacob cursed her unknowingly, not knowing that she did this. And by making that statement in verse 32, whoever took the gods. And so Rachel took them. If you go down to verse 34, it says, now Rachel had taken these images. Laban in verse 33 says he went to Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and the two maidservants, but he found them not. He just looks and looks and looks and can't find them. And he gets wroth. And it says that she took him, and it says in verse 34, she put him in the camel's furniture, and she sat on them. And Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. And she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise up before thee, for the custom of women is upon me. And he searched, and he found not the images, and he was wroth. And so what's happening in verse 35 is, Rachel's using cunning to hide the household gods. She's menstruating and anything that touches is unclean. So she hides the images and she sits on them and says, you know, you don't want to search under here because anything here is unclean. And so there's punning going on. Are these household gods unclean? Are they unclean in the sense that they're other gods? Are they unclean in the sense that they're stolen? What's going on? Later Midrash suggests more plausibly that she steals them to prevent their revealing to Laban that Jacob and the household had fled, because teraphim speak, according to one interpretation of Zechariah 10. Other modern scholars suggest that maybe Rachel wished to enjoy the protection of these gods, these household gods, these teraphim. One scholar, his name is Gunkel, he elaborates. He says it was the business of such teraphim to help protect the home and farm, to bless the family and the flocks. And Rachel believed that in stealing this image or these images, she was thus carrying along the fortune of the household. And Laban would sooner have given up anything rather than this household fetish of his, which he had given, which he himself had inherited from his father. In William Deaver's book, Did God Have a Wife? Archaeology and Folk Religion in Ancient Israel, he surmises that this was very common for local families to have household gods that they worshiped. Typically, they would be a lot of times votive statues or little statues that represented the god. And one of the most common one was the goddess or heavenly mother, as we would refer to her. And so we don't know exactly what's happening here, but we do know that something important is happening. One idea from scholarship is that whoever had the household gods had the key to inheritance. And so from a Latter-day Saint perspective, maybe we're talking about birthright. It's plausible. Something may be happening here that's of great importance. For example, it's been conjectured that Laban had no sons at the time that Jacob takes off. And so by carrying off the teraphim, by Rachel doing that, she's essentially claiming title to Laban's estate, something associated with, like we talked about, the birthright. It could be tantamount to her taking the title to the inheritance. This could be a key that opens up a lot of ways to read the text, and I like that idea. One scholar notes, he says, these lines are said to mean that the transfer of the father's household gods were a prerequisite in certain cases where property was to pass to a daughter's husband, or again, that when property is to pass to other than normal heirs, the household gods, as the protectors and symbols of the family holdings, are thus drawn in, as it were, to safeguard and to render legitimate not only the property, but also the person in relation to the property against possible future claims. And so perhaps these household gods were Rachel's way to make sure that they would have claim to lands from Laban. Now, this is not going to be relevant later because they're leaving, but that could be one of the things that could be tied to why she's doing this. A historian named Josephus, he says essentially this, that it was the custom among all the people in that country to have objects of worship in their house and to take them along with them wherever they left. And it's interesting that it's not explained why she takes the household gods. And according to Moshe Greenberg, a scholar who I will submit in the notes, you can read his paper about what's going on here. He says one of the reasons why it's not explained is because it was assumed that everybody knew. It was assumed that to the author of this text, that everybody would know, that the readers of this stuff would be like, well, of course. And so he says, why is the narrator of Genesis 31 silent about Rachel's motive? If the motive suggested by Josephus is correct, probably because the narrator regarded it as self-evident to his readers. And so maybe that's another reason why you leave a land, you take the gods with you. And you have to remember, it's kind of different for us today, but every land had their own local gods. And as strange as this may sound, this really does help explain a lot of the Old Testament. And so biblical writers are aware of this custom, and a person's compelled to leave their homeland carrying their gods with them. And we read that in 2 Kings 17 and Amos 3 and Isaiah 46. And then Greenberg writes, it's not surprising then that our narrator didn't think it necessary to explain to the readers why Rachel took these gods, because it would have been self-evident to them. And so I like that. I think that's probably a combination of all these things. We're talking about laying claim on the land, but we're also talking about taking these gods with us. We don't know what these teraphim were. The biggest or the most prolific teraphim that we found in the ground in Israel are these little mini statues of a woman. And typically she's known as Yahweh's Asherah or as Asherah. And that has the root, if you remember, we've talked about Asher, to be joyful or to be fortunate. That was the root of her name. And she was a goddess. And she was typically a mother goddess. And so I like to say or to think that this is probably related to Heavenly Mother, a mother figure who later is going to be castigated by the Deuteronomistic historian. But she's in here. She's in here very obliquely. And so whatever you want to do with this, this is certainly happening in Genesis 31. So to bring you back to the text, you've got verse 19, you've got 32, you've got 34. Jacob doesn't find the statues or these images, the teraphim. So verse 36 says that he was wroth and they leave. As they're about to leave, there's this narrative between Laban and Jacob where Jacob says, look, I've worked for you for 14 years. Like, what more do you want? And Laban is ticked, and he basically wants the cattle. Verse 43 says, Laban answered and said, "These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and these cattle are mine. All that you see is mine." And so Laban's pretty stingy, even though they made this agreement before that we talked about earlier with the speckled cattle and all that stuff happening at the end of chapter 30. Laban wants what Jacob's earned. And so there's a big narrative shift. We don't know what's happening, but in verse 43 is where they make the statement. But the end of the chapter, from basically verses 45 to the end of Genesis 31, there's a covenant, a heap of witness, an altar is built. They covenant peace between Laban and Jacob. And it says in verse 52 that there's this heap of witness, a pillar. And then verse 53 says, "The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father judge betwixt us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac." So it seems to be maybe even this tension that maybe there's a God of Nahor and a God of Abraham. Interesting. Verse 54, "Jacob offered a sacrifice upon the mount and called his brethren to eat bread, and they did eat bread and tarried all night in the mount. And in the morning, Laban rose up and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them, and Laban departed and returned in his place." So Laban kisses his kids and Jacob and Laban part ways. I think the author is telling us in verse 55 that Laban's not kissing Jacob. He's not his friend, but they depart in peace. And Jacob gets to take his flocks, his herds, and his spouse, and he's going to come back to the land of Israel in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. So 32, the chapter heading says that Jacob sees angels and he asks God to preserve him from Esau, for whom he prepares presents. And he wrestles all night with a messenger of God, and his name is changed to Israel. There's so much happening here and lots of ways to read it, but essentially his motive is he's so worried. He's worried that when he comes back that his brother Esau is going to kill him. If you remember, it's been 15 years since they've been together. And the last time he left, he was told that he was going to get killed. And so he comes and he gets his servants together and he prepares a bunch of animals, goats and sheep and rams and camels and colts and cows and bulls and donkeys and foals. And all that's in 13, 14, 15 of the chapter. Over and over again, he gets all these animals to give as a present, verse 18 says, to his brother. And he's over at this place called Jabbok, which is a wadi. It's called Wadi Zirka. And it's north of Qumran, and it's on the Jordan side of the River Jordan, so east of the River Jordan. So he stops here, and we don't know why he's going to go back, but the Jewish Midrash is that he goes back when he goes and meets this individual that he's going to wrestle. He goes back because there's some jars that he needs to go back and fetch. And when he goes back, he has this experience. It says, verse 22, "He rose up that night and two of his wives and two of his servants and his 11 sons, and he passed over the ford, and he took them and sent them over the brook over that he had. And then Jacob was left alone there," verse 24. And then it says that he wrestled with a man until the breaking of the day. And so there's a lot of different interpretations of that verse. Is he wrestling with himself? It says that he's alone. That's one option. Another option is he wrestling with a man? The text actually says that he's wrestling with a man. Other interpreters read this and say that he's wrestling God, because after this experience in verse 30, it says, "Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face." So some interpreters say that this experience in verse 24 to the end of the chapter has to do with his experience with God. So is he wrestling with himself? Is he wrestling with God? Is he wrestling with an angel? We don't know. Some say that he's wrestling with Esau's guardian angel, and because he can out-wrestle him, that he is going to be over Esau and going to take the birthright and be in control. So that's another interpretation. Joseph Fielding Smith says this, "Who wrestled with Jacob on Mount Peniel? The scriptures say it was a man. The Bible interpreters say it was an angel. More than likely, it was a messenger sent to Jacob to give him a blessing. To think that he wrestled and held an angel who couldn't get away is out of the question. The term angel is used in the scriptures at times and it refers to messengers who are sent with some important instruction. Later in this chapter, when Jacob said that he had beheld the Lord, that did not have reference to his wrestling. So Joseph Fielding Smith in Doctrines of Salvation, Volume 1, page 17, draws a distinction. And he says in verse 30, when Jacob, after this experience, says, I have seen God face to face, he says this is not talking about this angel. There's a lot of pictures in Christian art of him wrestling with an angel. The word angel, or angels, malakim or malak, it's a servant or someone that is sent to bear a message. And so we don't know. It's just he's called a man. But let's read the narrative in the King James. So he's left alone, and then it says he wrestled with a man until the breaking of the day. And that's also a pun on jabok and wrestle. It's pretty much the same word. So there's more punning going on. Verse 25, when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint, and he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So that's Jacob talking. And he said unto him, this man or this angel or whatever, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, tell me your name. And he said, why do you want to know my name? Essentially, it says, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? Really rough translation. And he blessed him there. So not the King James, but the Jewish Study Bible says this. He said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human and have prevailed. And Jacob asked, pray, tell me your name. But he said, you must not ask my name. And he took leave of him there. And so he doesn't tell him his name. He just leaves. We don't know who this person is. But then it says that Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. So let's throw a couple translations at you, or a couple ways to look at this. One is he's wrestling with himself. In other words, Jacob is coming to know more about Jacob in his experience. He's coming to know more about his divinity and more about who God is and about forgiveness. One rabbi writes this, Jacob is left alone. There is no other being, divine or human, not holy other and not holy brother. Jacob, perhaps for the first time in his life, is actually alone facing an opponent he cannot deceive, himself. He looks at himself and confronts an ish, a human being, with whom he is unfamiliar and with whom he is alienated. Jacob is blessed with an opportunity to change his identity by coming to terms with a part of himself that he has suppressed. I like that. I like that interpretation. I don't know if it's right, but I like that. Another interpretation of this is the book Enosh, or Enosh, which is punning on this ish or man. And Enos from the Book of Mormon is the son of Yaakov, Jacob, and he says that he wrestled with God. And so we're back to this word wrestling again. Enos, in the Book of Enos, is wrestling with God. It's a spiritual wrestle, and he has this dialogue with God, but it's not a physical wrestle. And so maybe the Book of Mormon authors are giving us a midrash on this. In other words, an inspired commentary, that this is a wrestling of sorts, but not a wrestling that you and I would distinguish, but a wrestling of a spiritual nature. And I think this fits, and I think this works. And so that's another way to read it. Another way to read it is that he's talking actually with an angel, and the angel gives him a new name, and the angel doesn't tell him who he is because the angel's like, hey, it's not important. His name is changed to Yisrael, and there's lots of ways to take the root of Israel, Yisra or Yesher, and it means to meet, whose right it is, or to be equal with. The back part of it is El, and El is the name of the God that the Elohist is going to continually refer to. El, or El Shaddai, or Elohim, and El is, to me, showing us that this is really, really old. This is an old tradition. E's pretty old stuff, and their version of God is generally this El being, not necessarily Yahweh. And so who's right it is, or who's right it is to meet or to be one with El. So Jacob's name is changed to actually fit, it's a pun, on this experience, if this individual is God or an angel or a divine being, meaning that you've seen God and that you've come into his presence. Notice verse 30, "For I have seen God face to face." Your name is not going to be Israel anymore in verse, or excuse me, your name is not going to be Jacob anymore in verse 28, but Israel, "for thou hast power with God and with men." In other words, thou hast experienced or prevailed with divine beings and with men. And it even says, "for thou hast prevailed." That's at the end of verse 28. So that's another way to read it, that he's getting a new name and it's a change in relationship. So I really like this. I really like 32 in connection with Jacob's ladder that we read last time. If you remember Jacob's ladder from Genesis 28, he lays down, he has a vision, he sees stairs go high into heaven and angels coming down and going up. That's in verse 12, and the Lord standing above it. So he sees God and he's promised seed and all the families of the earth were going to be blessed. And the Lord says, "I'm going to be with thee." And then he says, "Surely the Lord is in this place." So I like reading 32 in conjunction with 28 as like a temple experience. Now, think about all the ways that we've read this. He's met himself. He's met God. He's met an angel. The one we haven't really fleshed out is maybe he's wrestled an emissary on behalf of Esau. Esau has sent someone to him. And with the exception of that interpretation, all these others really tie into the temple. Think about the temple experience. You meet yourself. You ritually come back into God's presence, ritually receive a new name, ritually meet the Malachim, angels or emissaries that represent God. And so Genesis 32 is, like I said, multivalent, very beautiful, but also very enigmatic. We just don't know all what's going on. I get a lot of questions about what's going on with his hip or his thigh. And, you know, I really don't know what's going on there with that hip or that thigh being out of joint. One Jewish interpretation of his hip being torn out of joint was that Israel's offspring or the fruit of his loins would be alienated, torn away, and even executed. Now, this is staggering as we look at it today, many, many years later after this experience, but this could be a clue as to Jacob and his descendants. And we don't know. I don't know what's happening here, but there's something going on here at the end of Genesis 32. So the 33rd chapter we talked about last time, this is where he puts his families together and he kind of puts them in order. And so if you look in because he's coming back to the land of Israel, and it says that he put his handmaids and their children foremost, and then Leah and her children, and then Rachel, and then Joseph hindermost. And that's, we think, because he doesn't want Joseph to get hurt. But the point that's really cool is they run together in verse 4 of chapter 33, and it says, "Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and he saw the woman and the children and said, 'Who are those with thee?' And he said, 'The children which God has graciously given thy servant.'" And so they have this beautiful reunion and everything's going to be put back together. They have this peace and this brotherhood that's been restored after a 14-year separation. Now, granted, Rebecca is dead. He never sees his mother again, but he's reunited with his brother Esau. At the end of the chapter, it says that he purchases the land of Shechem. Shechem's right there in the middle of Israel today in a place called Nablus, and it's going to be a really important point of great events in the biblical narrative later with Moses. But for now, he buys the land. It says, "Jacob came to Shechem, the city of Shechem, which is the land of Canaan. And he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent, and he bought a parcel of the field that he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar, and he worshiped God." So that's the end of Genesis 33, where he goes and he purchases the land. That's from E. That's from the northern author. And it's very simple. Jacob purchases the land. The southern author, J, is going to tell us a different story. And in J, or the southern author, Shechem is going to be purchased by blood. And it's going to denigrate two of the tribes, two of the tribes of Israel are going to be denigrated as pretty brutal guys. And these two tribes are Levi and Simeon. Levi and Simeon are going to acquire the land through death and destruction. So this is, once again, two ways that we get the land of Shechem. The first way is we purchase it, and it's very peaceful. The second way, from a southern point of view, it's because the northern tribes were bad. And in a nutshell, what happens is Dinah, who is the daughter of Leah, Dinah's the daughter of Leah. It says it right there in chapter 34, verse 1, that she is basically raped. It says, Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite prince of the country, saw her, and he took her, and he lay with her, and he defiled her. And so this is not a happy story. And so what happens? Well, I really like what Jacob does. Look at verse 5. It says, Jacob held his peace. He just stops. And the brothers are really mad. They want to go get revenge. And Jacob, he's trying to avoid it. He's trying to avoid revenge and try to find a peaceful solution there. It says in verse 7, the sons of Jacob came out when they heard about it, and they were grieved and they were wroth because he had wrought folly in Israel in line with Jacob's daughter. And Hamor, so the father of this offending son, he communes with them and he says, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife and make marriages with us. And verse 10 says, trade with us. And Shechem said to her father in verse 11, let me find grace in your eyes. Verse 12, ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as ye shall say, but give me the damsel to wife. In other words, he says, at any price, I'll take her, I'll have her. Now, a lot of modern interpretations and a lot of devotional readings of this say things like this. What's the price of your chastity? You know, what would you do? And I like these modern questions, but we need to remember that this is an ancient text. And so anciently when that happened, then it would be an exchange between the man and the father of the woman, and they would exchange a bride price. But in our modern readings, we read this and we're just like, oh my goodness, you know, what is the price of chastity? And the answer is, well, there is no price. And so that both readings, I think, work. But the sons of Jacob are really fired up, and they're like, you know what? He's raped our sister. And they said, we can't do this thing to give our sister to this guy. And they say, to one that is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach. So they're pretty fired up. So they come up with a plan, and they say this. They say to all the men of the city of Shechem, if you guys, the whole city will be circumcised, then we will let our sister marry this prince. And so they do. They all say, we want to be one people. And so they all get circumcised. And in that moment, when they're in that condition, and they're really, really, the text says that they're very sore. So in verse 25, when it says that they were sore, you know, obviously these men are not going to be doing a lot after this experience, and they're very sore. It says in verse 25 that the sons of Jacob, specifically Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, they took every man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem, so the father and the son, with the edge of the sword, and they took Dinah and they leave. And it says in verse 27 that they spoiled the city and even everything that was in the house. And Jacob's pretty upset in verse 30. And Jacob says to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land. And then their question that they ask is rhetorical at the end. Should he deal with our sister as a harlot? And so that's the end of the 34th chapter. And it really is graphically illustrated about how these brothers feel about their sister, how they feel about rape, how they feel about outsiders. And it's a very difficult text. One of the things the author is doing is he's setting up the brothers. In my opinion, I think what's happening here is we're setting up the brothers as the potential brothers who are to inherit the birthright are being knocked down one by one. Now, later we'll see it with Reuben. Reuben's going to, in chapter 35, do something that's going to remove him from birthright consideration. But in this chapter, chapter 34, we've now knocked out Simeon and Levi for consideration of birthright because of their bad behavior. Later, we'll see some stuff going on with Judah. But another thing we're seeing here through this editorial process is, and we will see it later in future podcasts, is the rising up of Joseph as the birthright son. But for now, we're knocking down Simeon and Levi. And this is once again a text that's told from a southern perspective, from Judah. And if you remember, in 921 BC, Judah and the other 10 tribes of Israel, we break. There's this schism and they fracture. And each one of these geographical areas, the north and the south, have their texts and their textual traditions about how things happened. And this editorial process of bringing these texts back together occurs after the scattering of Israel. After 721 BC, when Assyria comes in and takes the northern tribes, those that are literate, those that can, take texts with them to the south. And so the southern texts and the northern texts are combined into what is known in scholarship as JE, the Yahwist and the Elohist, or like, as I like to refer to it, as chocolate and peanut butter. We make Reese's peanut butter cups from this combination of these traditions. Now, what do we do with this? What's a good devotional reading here? Well, for one thing, rape's bad. Family's good. I would say another devotional reading here is, don't make decisions in anger. Notice what it says in verse 7, they were grieved and they were wroth, but verse 5, Jacob held his peace. So there's something to be said about waiting to make a decision, especially when you're mad. There's also a lot in here about, well, how do we treat people? Dinah is not property, but she's a person. And so I like the brothers in the sense that they want to defend her honor. I don't commend them in the sense that they do it with violence. But we certainly see that in the text, because once again, we're reading the Bible and it's a Bronze Age document. But I want to end with this thought from the 64th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And it says in verse 8, the Lord says, my disciples in days of old sought occasion against one another and forgave not one another in their hearts. And for this evil, they were afflicted and sorely chastened. And so the Lord is inviting us to repent. And he's also inviting us not just to repent, but to forgive people that trespass against us. And then he says, wherefore I say to you that you ought to forgive one another. For he that forgiveth not his brother his trespasses standeth condemned before the Lord, for there remaineth in him the greater sin. I, the Lord, will forgive whom I will forgive, but of you it is required to forgive all men. And so in all things, let us remember, we all have faults and we do need to forgive others. This is a very difficult story in the sense of the sin being very great. But I think the punishment that Simeon and Levi execute, the punishment is worse than the crime. And it exceeds those bounds. And for this reason, I think the author put it in here to say, hey, this is another reason why these two brothers are going to be taken out of consideration for the birthright. But it's also trying to explain, how did the Israelites come to possess this land? And so the scriptures are doing a lot of things, right? They're inviting us to repent and do better. They're also showing us poor behavior of others so that maybe we won't make those same mistakes. And so that's another invitation that we're given. And so with that, I thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.